This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. The Honolulu City Council is poised to take a final vote on Friday on whether to approve footing the legal bill for the impeachment petition for City Prosecutor Keith Kaneshiro. Alexander Silbert, a deputy federal public defender, submitted a letter to the Star Advertiser outlining what he thinks they should be considering in open session. We talked to him about the way forward.
The op-ed piece that I wrote and what I was concerned about regarding this issue is that this is a extraordinary event that's taking place. I don't think in the history of Hawaii has this issue come up of whether or not an attorney should be appointed, one, for an impeachment process, which is a political process, and then second, for really what amounts to a disciplinary counsel request where the Attorney General is asking the Supreme Court, in its capacity as the overseer of the attorneys in this state, whether they should suspend an attorney due to the appearance of impartiality, a lack of impartiality in cases, which is really what we would call an Office of Disciplinary Counsel request, where an attorney is being possibly sanctioned for misconduct, rather than any criminal wrongdoing, which may or may not occur if an indictment is ever issued. So these are extraordinary questions. I don't think they've really been answered before. And what I'm hoping is that we have a process in the City Council where we are really educated about why they're doing things and how it's being done, so the cloud of suspicion that has arisen over state government and how it acts in terms of our monies, especially given the $250,000 that was given to ex-chief of police Kealoha, that we really have an open process so we understand.
And that particular settlement caused a lot of hand-wringing, I think, on both sides of the aisle, the police commission and also the city council. When I talked to Ann Kobayashi, she had said that they were just told that it wasn't something that they could vote on because it wasn't using – it was going to be using HPD's money. So she was concerned about that. But then also, now, you would like to see these proceedings in an open forum, right?
That's correct, because I know there's this discussion that if it involves allegedly a personnel matter, that they're all done in executive session. I think this is really not that situation. We have one process and one question which is being asked, which is, should Mr. Kaneshiro receive an attorney for a political question, an impeachment process? That has nothing to do with a personnel matter. It may involve his activities in his job, but it's really just a simple question of, should we appoint an attorney for any elected official who is facing impeachment, which is an act of voters who put them into office attempting to remove them from office. The second issue is really a disciplinary issue, where an attorney would appear before the disciplinary board and defend themselves against some claim that their actions as an attorney under their licensing agreement with the state was somehow in jeopardy due to their actions. Again, that's not a personnel decision. That is a disciplinary counsel decision in the way that the Attorney General has framed it. So what I'm hoping is that the City Council will understand that these are very unique and distinct actions, and each one needs to be analyzed separately. And it should be done in the open. There is no reason that these kinds of questions can't be discussed in public.
And given the lack of transparency, I guess, when this settlement was negotiated with the chief, do you think this is more of a case for this to be discussed openly?
What happened with the chief of police and the $250,000, whatever happened in that proceeding, and we really don't know, but whatever happened, it's given rise to the feeling in the community that something just isn't right and that we need to have these things done in the open for public scrutiny, have the press play its role in ferreting it out questions and getting answers so that we understand what's happening. So there is no cloud of suspicion. And I think that's the problem that we're facing now, is we have this cloud of suspicion, and it can easily be addressed if we just discuss these matters in the open.
You mentioned this is unprecedented, and we also have the city's top civil lawyer stepping away because of a letter from the federal government. Public trust, I guess, is something that might be paramount right now.
That's what this is all about. We have this opportunity. The city council has this opportunity to demonstrate its belief in the public, its willingness to understand that the public plays a role in this, and that they serve the public. And they have that opportunity in this proceeding, and I really hope they don't miss it.
I attended one of the early hearings on the impeachment motion, and there was just lots of ambiguity about the process.
There was rules and procedures in place years ago when the impeachment process was spelled out more clearly, and it went directly to the Supreme Court of Hawaii. The legislature changed that rule and changed the law to allow impeachment petitions to go first to the Circuit Court of the District of Hawaii in Honolulu. The problem is that when they did that, all of the rules and procedures that had been in place were erased. So basically all we have now is a petition for impeachment goes to the Circuit Court and nothing else is spelled out. And so obviously, in the future, this is going to have to be addressed because it does raise issues of due process. It does raise issues of proper procedure and notice and giving judges clear guidance on how they're supposed to proceed. We shouldn't rush into these things. You know, the circuit court judge is having this issue right now, and I'm sure Mr. Kaneshiro will make whatever challenges he thinks are appropriate, and that'll play out in the court system. But I think at some point, once that happens, the legislature is going to have to take it up and have to clarify its position.
What do you make of the situation where you now have a number of cases taken out of the city prosecutor's office and handed over to the state attorney general?
Well, I'm glad to see that happen. It's about time. It should have happened a long time ago. And that's going to raise issues that relate to the attorney general's petition because she's claiming in that petition that this is something that he should have done. He should have done it a long time ago, and it's evidence that Mr. Kaneshiro's office is not running effectively and efficiently. And the fact that he's only taken these steps now is only going to support the Attorney General's petition. I mean, what I think the public needs to understand, and certainly government officials need to understand, we are in uncharted waters here. No one knows really how this process should work and how it's going to work properly. And we should take it deliberately and slowly. But this process is critical, it's important, and it really needs to be done so everybody understands it. So whatever the end result is, know it's above suspicion, and everybody understands it. And you can agree or you can disagree with the end result, but there really needs to be a process whereby no one is suspicious about what has happened.
And has anyone checked, is there any kind of case law anywhere where something similar has happened in another jurisdiction?
The problem with these issues is that every state is different. We're dealing with state laws. So every state has different rules and procedures of how to discipline lawyers or how to impeach public officials and where that process goes. So while you might look to other states to, you know, have some instruction, I don't necessarily think you're going to find it. But we have some national things that have happened that are illustrative. For example, let's not forget, when President Bill Clinton faced impeachment, he did not get a free attorney. He had to hire his own attorneys. President Trump right now is hiring his own attorneys in this whole possible impeachment process. So if you want to look to the nation, then you have some illustrations and some guidance as to how this should be all worked out.
Okay, but at the end of the day, it's about the process in restoring public faith and public trust in the system that we have.
Absolutely. That's paramount. And, you know, that's what I was writing about in my op-ed piece was, let's lead the nation. Let's be the state. Let's be the government that is open, that takes this seriously, that understands the importance of it, that addresses the issues openly, fairly, publicly. And again, you know, I represent a lot of clients in criminal court who don't get the sentences they necessarily would like to see. But I know that when the court is open and fair and has listened to them and has explained their reasoning, they accept the sentence. And I think the public is the same way. If you're open and you're honest and you explain yourself, the public, whether they agree or don't, will accept the result.
Okay. And then you are credited with bringing this mailbox case to the attention of the FBI.
That was, boy, that seems like a century ago, because that was 2014 that all this really started. Going to the FBI and the U.S. Attorney's Office was the end of December 2014 and January 2015. So it seems like a long time ago.
Did you think, though, that little pebble would ripple out like it has?
I did not expect to see the things that we are seeing now at all. I kind of feel, I've been telling people when they ask me about this, it's kind of like when you pull that loose thread on a sweater, and you just pull a little bit, and then you keep pulling, and the sweater just starts to unravel. And I think my case was that first tug, that first pull on that loose thread, and it's just continuing to be unwound.
Is there anything that's kind of just shocked you on a personal level?
You know, I think, like in a lot of cases we're seeing in nationwide, it's the obstruction. It's the attempt by people who get caught up in this at whatever level of government or they are to obstruct. That always amazes me. And sometimes, as we've often seen the case, the obstruction is worse than the original crime.
That was Deputy Federal Prosecutor Alex Silbert talking about whether taxpayers ought to pay the legal bill for Honolulu City Prosecutor Keith Kaneshiro. He is advocating that the conversation not take place behind closed doors. Silbert hopes the council will reach out to other attorneys knowledgeable about constitutional law, other than just relying on the Corporation Counsel's lawyers, who may have a narrow view on the issue.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Friends of the Waikiki Aquarium's Distinguished Lecture Series, entitled Minerals, Fisheries, and Food Webs, with Dr. Jeff Drazen, 6 p.m. this Thursday at Tenney Theater.
Our bodies need cholesterol, but how much is too much? And what should you do if you're concerned it's starting to build up in the body and cause blockages? Are there any natural things you can do about it? I'm Dr. Kathleen Kozak. Join me today on The Body Show. We'll talk with an expert about the latest in natural ways to treat cholesterol. That's today at 6:30 on The Body Show.
Out-of-towners with a legal prescription for medical marijuana can now make room in their suitcase for something else to buy while in the islands. HPR's Kuve Hiraishi is here live this morning to talk about this latest benchmark. Morning.
Good morning, Catherine. That's right. So we are anticipating an announcement from the State Department of Health tomorrow about this rollout of the medical cannabis program for our out-of-state patients. So right now, anyone with a medical marijuana card from another state cannot go into a dispensary and just, you know, present their card and buy products from these dispensaries. But once this rollout kind of takes place, what's going to happen is, this is what we know from the website now, the details of this program, is these out-of-state patients can apply for a temporary card. So it'll last 60 days, they apply for it online, and then once they come to Hawaii, they'll have that temporary card to go ahead and purchase products from the dispensaries.
So they don't have to basically use the product while they're here. They can take it back with them, though, right?
That I'm not sure on, no. Because from what I hear from the dispensaries, what's going to happen is a lot of these sort of smoke-free laws that we have in Hawaii don't allow them to, exactly like you said, consume some of the medicine here. But they're trying to increase production, the dispensaries are, of products like lozenges and tinctures and things that allow them to still use their medicine while they are here.
Because I wouldn't wonder about that when folks do travel, you know, the complications that could ensue when they're going through the TSA. I mean, I just don't know how that all works.
Right. Under federal, so federal guidelines actually prevent them from going ahead and transporting these across borders. But with this dispensary sale program, they'll be able to purchase it here in Hawaii. So that was sort of an access question for patients who need medical marijuana for their particular ailments. They'll be able to purchase it here. So in other states right now, I think there are only two that I've noticed, Michigan and Rhode Island, that allow out-of-state patients to purchase marijuana from these dispensaries. So in other areas or in other states, medical marijuana programs exist, and you can, as an out-of-state patient, possess medical marijuana in the state, but you cannot purchase it in the state. So these are for folks on the mainland who get to drive across borders and not have to fly like to Hawaii. But I reached out to some of these dispensaries to figure out what they're anticipating, you know, with the rollout, if this is big good news or if this is something they've been sort of anticipating for a long time now. So I spoke to Tori Staples. She's the assistant deputy our assistant dispensary director over at Cure Oahu, and they are the closest to the tourist mecca that is Waikiki. They're off of Kapahulu Avenue, one of their dispensaries. And she actually was back in Maine in 2011 when Maine rolled out their what's called a reciprocity program, or a program for out-of-state patients. This is what she had to say about the rollout there.
I was lucky enough to be able to really get in on the ground level in the Maine medical marijuana industry. We saw a lot of Massachusetts and New Hampshire and Maine all started their programs around the same time. So the transition, although quite easy, we had no idea the amount of people that we were going to start seeing.
So she's anticipating more of a big influx for the most part. Right now we have a little over 23,000 registered patients here in Hawaii. And so I think initial conversations from the Department of Health was they were considering capping the first sort of push of out-of-state patients at 5,000 because they wanted to make sure there would be adequate supply of products for the in-state patients as well,
yes,
which we have to think about when we roll out programs like this. But there is no confirmation on whether or not that cap may be in place with the, you know, we'll know more details tomorrow. But those are some of the conversations they're having around this program.
Because I can just see, right? I mean, we've always heard, oh, Maui Wowie, right? And the branding. So you come to Hawaii, you load up on your medical marijuana from Hawaii that's locally grown.
Right.
You know, but all kinds of questions. Can you take this medical marijuana from island to island? Can you take it back to California with you or what?
So that from island to island is definitely not allowed. That is a problem or a challenge, I should say, for the county of Maui, because there are two dispensaries on Maui Island. But Maui County, which also includes Lanai and Molokai, do not have one. And so they are still prohibited from taking that medicine back to, if they purchase it on Maui, taking it back to Molokai. So I do know inter-island wise that remains a challenge. I also got to speak to the CEO of Noa Botanicals, Brian Goldstein. They just opened their second dispensary, so one of the only licensees on the island of Oahu that has two dispensaries right now, and they opened it on the windward side. But he had he said he's more cautiously optimistic when it comes to this inflow of out-of-state patients. He doesn't anticipate there to be too much of an increase. He thinks that the way that the program is set up in terms of not being able to just take anyone who has a medical marijuana card from another state, they can't just come in and show their out-of-state card. They do need to apply for this temporary card from the Department of Health here in Hawaii. And he thinks that that extra sort of to-do list or that extra task might be too cumbersome for folks who are just going to come here for a week and, you know, and they don't want to go through this process. But I got to speak to him, and this is what he anticipates.
There is, I think, a big misconception that that reciprocity is going to lead to this massive influx of new patients, and I don't see that happening. Not until we have a reciprocity program that recognizes the actual out-of-state card itself. So someone could walk in with a Colorado medical card or a Massachusetts medical card or a Michigan medical card. So I'm cautiously optimistic, but I don't think it's going to have a significant impact.
And we should say that there is no residency requirement on the medical marijuana 329 cards here in Hawaii. So technically, folks who are visiting from out of state and who might come here frequently can apply for a card here in Hawaii and have that when they come and go.
So how long is that card good for again?
The temporary card will be 60 days.
Wow. Interesting. Anything else that you think? I guess we have to wait and see what they announce.
Tomorrow we'll get the details from the Department of Health of exactly how this is going to go. We also anticipate that these cards will now be available by email, which will make it easier for out-of-state patients, but also local patients to get their cards in a faster turnaround.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks, Kuvehi. We have been talking with Kuvehi Hiraishi about how visitors can now have their medical marijuana prescriptions filled here while on their Hawaiian vacation. You can find her stories online at hawaiipublicradio.org. And later this week, we'll have a call-in show on recreational marijuana. Stay tuned for that.
Aloha. I'm Maya Sutoro Ng from the Matsunaga Institute for Peace and Conflict Resolution. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Heavens to Murgatroyd, exit stage left. That was a favorite line of mine by the cartoon character Snagglepuss. But there's nothing funny about losing your land to Mother Nature in rising sea levels and having to head to higher ground. That's the subject of the reality check with our partners at Honolulu Civil Beat. Nathan Eagle is on the line. Morning.
Morning.
So, yeah, having to head for the hills. That's what your story's all about today.
It really is, and it's a lot of different homeowners that I've talked to who aren't sure exactly if they do that, where they would go or how they would afford it. And there's others who are like, no, you know, I bought this property and I'm here to fight to keep it. I just could use maybe a little support from Sater County policies to help me. But the real thrust of what I was trying to get across is that these aren't all just big multimillionaires, you know, who live along the coast. There's still so many who are just your regular middle class folks and some low income folks who bought their homes decades or even generations ago.
Now, I was talking to someone who I know lives in Kahala, and he was saying, oh, maybe it's time for me to sell my home and, you know, buy a condo in Kaka'ako or somewhere higher where he doesn't have to deal with this whole issue of rising sea levels.
Absolutely. There's no shortage of folks like that. And, you know, if you look at the online mapping tools and reports that have come out in the past year or two, it's showing, you know, $20 billion in damage to buildings and roads alone, you know, not counting any kind of, you know, economic multiplier. You know, as sea levels rise, a projected 3 feet between now and the end of the century. Some are even projecting much sooner than that.
Now, we just saw that recent report talking about the managed retreat, right, from DBED, Business of Economic Development.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's getting a very mixed reaction, to say the least. One homeowner I talked to in Pupukea, I used to live there at his home for 20 years. He wants to retire and spend his retirement years there. He raised his family there, sent them kids to public schools there. He's saying, no, we're not going to run for the hills. What we want to do is try some different erosion management solutions, not managed retreat policies. He thinks that the state is really just kind of coming up with this philosophy to kind of allow them to put this all on the homeowners and have them retreat. You know, obviously he's pointing at the approach or the outlook for Waikiki and Honolulu's urban core as being, oh, well, they're going to armor that because it's, you know, worth billions. But us folks out in the more rural areas, where's our help?
Well, if I recall, that report says, you know, it may not be the best thing to have taxpayers bail all the folks that live along the coastlines, you know, but to bail them out, essentially.
Right. And that is what it comes down to. I mean, you look at the mapping tools and things like that. It's very clear where the water is projected to come in the next 10, 20, 30, 40 or more years. The question is, well, who pays for a retreat if that's the best approach? Who pays for moving a highway backwards, too? You know, that obviously fall on taxpayers. But do you put the homes then on the other side of that? What do you do and who ultimately pays for that?
Maybe there should be a sliding scale. The folks that really can't afford, and the folks that really have the $10 million homes along the shoreline. I don't know.
Yeah, that's something being discussed too. They had hoped that report was going to kind of spell out a step by step plan. Okay, homeowners, you're in this zone. Here's what you need to do. But it kind of just grew so complex that they just sort of laid out, yep, this is one philosophy. Here are some factors to consider. And then I think they hope to drill down more into specifics later.
So we really don't have any kind of inventory, though, right, of the types of properties we're talking about.
I'm a little unclear on what kind of inventory is available at this point. It's what is clear is exactly kind of where it's projected to be affected the worst. You know, places like Pupukea or the North Shore, Sunset Beach, and then other folks I talked to are on the bend in Haula. All the projections there are showing increases in flooding and things like that as the sea levels come up. And it wasn't new to them. They didn't even need to see these tools. They're seeing it firsthand already. One homeowner, she's lived on the coast there in Haula for 38 years. She's a retired public school teacher on a fixed income. And she's saying, hey, so until the past 6 or 7 years, I wasn't dealing with these giant sinkholes in my backyard until recently. So what do I do?
Well, it's kind of a sobering thought when someone says, well, you live on the shoreline there, you're doomed.
Yeah, that's what Chip Fletcher, the UH professor and climate scientist, told me. Ultimately, where you are is doomed and you're in a no-win situation. You need to figure out an exit strategy.
Yeah, exit stage left. Heavens to Murgatroyd. I guess, yeah, there's not a good way, not a good position to be in.
No, it's not a good-looking postcard.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Nathan. Appreciate your report.
Thanks.
That was reporter Nathan Eagle with today's Reality Check. To read this latest story and others about rising sea levels and climate change, visit civilbeat.org.
The United States is now the world's leading producer of crude oil, and with more oil comes more trucking, and with more trucking comes more traffic accidents.
There's such a rush to fill trucking positions that we're not focusing on safety training that we used to be able to.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, traffic in the oil patch, next time on Marketplace.
This evening at 6.
Over the next few weeks, expect to see additional data released about Oahu's homeless. More puzzle pieces as we try and get a good snapshot of the situation in the urban and rural areas. Overall, the trend is that the numbers are down. Sam Millington is with Partners in Care, which oversaw the recent point-in-time count here on Oahu.
Overall numbers are down 4%, and we know nationwide, especially in large urban areas, the numbers are rising. So I think that's a testament to success. What the city and the state, both through the governor's office and through the legislature, were on the right path. But there's caveats to that, as there often are. The shelter population went way down. Part of that, though, was one of the shelters, a large shelter, Ulu Ke Kukui, closed. And that was 74 families and about 300 beds. But it closed in a good way. It was going to close, but the result was good because all those people got some sort of permanent housing. So if the wraparound services are there to hold them in housing, that's 300 family members who will no longer be homeless.
And why did that particular shelter close?
I think it's part of the Ohana Zone transition. So it will be repurposed. Catholic Charities is handling it. So that will be more resources for the community. And one of the results could be, I don't like to predict or and I don't know all the exact details, but one of the results of that is, so you took 300 people out of a shelter, and then you've created a new kind of system through the Ohana zones, and you may be taking some of the unsheltered off the streets next year. So we may well see a decline in the unsheltered next year, with another large caveat, assuming there's no other reason to create more homelessness, like an economic dislocation that we can't control. The count is the sheltered homeless and the unsheltered homeless together. So the overall is 4% down. The sheltered is 19% down, but the unsheltered is 12% up. So if you look at the exact numbers, it averages out to 4% down. But what we see in the public is we see the unsheltered. We don't see, unless we work in a shelter or volunteer, we don't necessarily see that. But these are the people that we can get into housing most easily from the shelters. And so Mayor Caldwell makes a great point in saying, if we can just get people off the street into the shelters, then we have a better chance of getting them permanent housing.
Okay, but you do have numbers that show over the past, I guess, 5 years,
yes,
that the numbers have gone down, and that's the bottom line. It doesn't really matter over last year so much, is that there is this trend downward.
There is a trend. The last 2 years for the overall have gone down, and that's important. And I think that is testament to the programs that are being set in place are working. The challenge is homelessness is a 50-year problem, and we need to keep addressing it. So it's very important that the legislature understand that process and continue to allocate and fund the programs that are working.
Where are we at as far as funding in the bills this session?
So the bills that Partners in Care is advocating for, they're all, in one way or another, they're all still alive. And the key ones are to support the core proven services, outreach, rapid rehousing, the LEAD program, which is a law enforcement assisted diversion. The LEAD program, technically, if someone is the police find an individual who's homeless and he's not necessarily committing a crime, but it might be a serious crime. They can call outreach workers who have a certain amount of time to come and get those people into a shelter or some other appropriate place. So that's the diversion part. So funding for that, funding for Housing First, the Family Assessment Center, and the Coordinated Statewide Homeless Initiative. Last year was $13.5 million funding, I think it was, in that package. We would hope it would be $16.5 this year because we see that these programs are working. But at least if it can be matched to last year, and if it could be put into a base budget so that nonprofits don't have to scramble every year for funding. The big ticket item, however, is for housing. So if we can figure out a way to get low-income housing, it was $200 million last year, and this year I think the governor's budget had $125. So if we can at least get $125 million for low-income housing and carve out $75 million for permanent supportive housing, that will make a huge difference. And the other thing is these things take time. It takes time to find developers, it takes time to build. So we need to have patience. We need to give it a 5-year, a 10-year frame of reference. But we know that the initial seedlings in the ground are starting to break. These are not supposed to be accurate numbers, 100% accurate numbers of everybody who is homeless. They're supposed to give us a sense of the trends. As we break down into the subpopulations and the regions, it takes more time. So we anticipate over the course of the next month to be releasing different batches of data. It may be that within the next 2 weeks we're ready to release the regional data. And then maybe data towards Native Hawaiians after that, or data towards the mentally ill. We have a number of categories. And we're also collaborating with certain stakeholders. So OHA and Liliuokalani Trust and Partners in Care have signed an MOU, and we're working very closely together. It's a really wonderful relationship. And we're going to be able to look at Native Hawaiian numbers more carefully, in more depth, and with more resources than ever before.
So the bottom line, though, with these numbers is that you can go to the legislature and say, these programs work.
Each year, we're taking more people off the streets, we're putting them in, we need to get more housing, we need to have the, but the thing with the housing is that Ulu Ke Kukui shelter closing and the people going to housing, what we need to remember is it's not enough to put people in housing if they have challenges. If we don't have the support services, then they could end up homeless again.
What's your take on the Ohana Zone? Do you think it's a good idea or not?
I don't know. I think it's a great idea. I think I think sometimes you have to go in the garage and try things, and you may have to tinker and tweak. And it was not, there wasn't a lot of lead time to prepare for that. So I really understand, have a lot of empathy for the state, because you can't stand up a complicated project in a year unless, you know, unless you're maybe Microsoft or something. I mean, you know, doing a particular IT thing. This is really complicated stuff. There's economics. There's social.
We're talking about people. We're not talking about metal and,
and
computer parts.
We're talking about people, but also the whole process of getting things built quickly and then putting it together properly. So, yeah, could we rush things and get them built, but then not have all the other infrastructure we need to make it, including the social surface infrastructure? So I think it's a great idea. I think we need to give it time, have some patience, let all the stakeholders involved in the Ohana Zone process figure it out and keep moving forward. We oversee a $9.5 million allocation process of federal funding. I don't think most people realize that. We spearhead advocacy efforts. Some people may have an idea of that. People can come to us or our website, and we're an information and resource dissemination hub. We get information out. So if you had information you wanted to get out, your volunteer at Agency X, you give it to us. We put it out in the air, and we put it in our listserv. We manage a comprehensive homeless database. And we're developing a research arm to that. Our goal, this is new, but this is my goal, is to create a mini think tank where we can do analytical stuff. So part of that work with OHA and Liliuokalani Trust is going in that direction.
So it's not just getting the numbers, but then using those numbers to figure out how we can be more efficient with our programs.
Yeah, and understanding the implications. And, you know, so there'll be hopefully a little bit of more of an academic component, too, attached to that. And then, of course, we have the CES, the Coordinated Entry System, which is the referral to get the vulnerable folks into housing. And so that's a really important part of what we do. And then finally, we do host the annual statewide homeless awareness conference. So we have a lot on our plate that I don't think most people realize.
That was Sam Millington of Partners in Care talking about the point-in-time count. Honolulu Mayor Kirk Caldwell hailed the results at a recent news conference, but there are still few details being released about the legal cloud that surfaced on the enforcement of illegal campers in public areas.
Well, we've been told that there are some issues regarding how the bills were drafted, and we want to make sure that before we actually use them, that we're not going to be subject to legal challenge in which we're going to be stopped and perhaps be fined or assessed an inordinate amount of money for trying to do something. But I am, as mayor, not backing away from 51 and 52. We want to get it right. We want to use more laser-like legislation that deals with obstructions on our sidewalks and lodging on our sidewalks.
That was the latest piece of a complex puzzle dealing with homeless encampments and those who refuse to go into emergency shelters. This is The Conversation on listener-supported Hawaii Public Radio. We now check in with University of Hawaii's Christopher Phillips and HPR's Dave Lawrence with your Monday Stargazer.
Stargazer time, our weekly look into the massive universe around our tiny planet, also what we can try and spot in our dark skies. We are grateful to have the expertise of Christopher Phillips to turn to. Hey, Christopher, welcome back. What do you have for us this week?
Hey, Dave, it's good to be back. So this week's stargazers look out for Mars in the western sky after sunset, and both Venus and Saturn in the early morning sky before dawn. The moon is a mere crescent this week.
And this week, I understand you are taking us to the outer solar system for not one, but two stories?
Indeed. First was a surprise announcement that the farthest object known has been detected in the dark depths of the outer solar system. This object orbits the sun at an astonishingly large distance of 13 billion miles. Because it's so far out, it has been given the catchy name of Far Far Out. Similarly, a team led by astronomer Mike Brown, a frequent visitor to the Subaru Observatory atop Mauna Kea, has stated that they expect to find the mysterious Planet 9 sometime in the next few years.
Tell us a little bit more about this.
Well, it's expected to not be a planet. In fact, it's almost certainly going to be a small icy body, probably similar to those found in the Kuiper Belt, albeit very, very far away. However, we can't say for certain what it is right now because it exists at our very limits of detection.
And one would think Planet 9 would be a lot bigger, so it would be easier to spot. But then again, when you realize how tiny Pluto really is...
Indeed, and Planet 9 has still proven to be elusive, despite having an estimated mass approximately 10 times that of the Earth, which would make it a large ice giant planet, similar to Uranus or Neptune. However, Brown's team have only an approximate location for its orbit.
This Planet 9 thing is not one of these mysterious conspiracy theory-laden things you find on the internet or wherever else, right?
It is not. It is a purely natural phenomenon.
And if they know the orbit on this thing, can't they just do the math and kind of calculate where it might be?
Well, the physics makes it seem that it's pretty easy, right? But the area of the sky they have to scan is huge. And also, Planet X, if it is indeed there, is going to be very, very faint and very, very cold, meaning visible and infrared detection is going to be very hard indeed. However, I'm confident that eventually Brown's team will find it.
That is, unless it has its cloaking device activated. It's Stargazer and Christopher Phillips. Thank you.
You are welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence, and you can find it on demand at HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
Support for Stargazer comes from Ferraro Choi, celebrating its 30th anniversary and 25 years of support for Hawaii Public Radio, committed to environmentally sustainable architecture and interior design. FerraroChoi.com.
On this week's On the Media, a breaking news consumer's handbook for the reporting bonanza around the Mueller investigation.
Normally, you know, you see a bunch of rocks and you have to think, you know, which rock should I turn over and how hard do I got to dig to pull it out? And this is one of these very unusual situations where actually pretty much every rock you turn over has something.
Don't miss this week's On the Media from WNYC.
This evening at 7.
Hurricane season is right around the corner. Severe storms are nothing new, but they can be a major disruption to life in coastal areas around the world. HPR's Ryan Finnerty was curious about how storms affect the all-important ocean shipping industry here in Hawaii. To find out more, he spoke with Brad Dechter, president of the freight company Dependable Hawaiian Express.
Normally, they want the ships out to sea where the waves are higher during a storm, but they can't hit anything. And that keeps the crew safer, and that keeps the assets on the shore safer. So they take the boats out to sea, the vessels out to sea, so that they're basically, as long as they're seaworthy and they can beat the waves, so to speak, they're better off at sea. They can't hurt anything.
And so, Brad, what kind of conditions are these ships designed to handle? You mentioned that some of them are being sent out to sea fully loaded with containers. How safe is it for those ships and the cargo and the crew that are out there?
Honestly, I'm not an expert on this, but the Coast Guard and Matson have been doing this for 100 years. Peixia or whoever Matson's previous rivals were had a long track record. I think that they all agree they're safer out at sea. Now, I know that the waves, they were talking about 42-foot waves out there, and these vessels can absolutely handle those size waves. You know, they've got built-in stabilizers. They've got ways of stabilizing the vessel so that when the waves come, the vessel can handle it. And, of course, depending on which way the waves come, the vessels position themselves so they're not broadsided.
And this is a pretty regular occurrence, I would think, for people in your line of work. Storms happen all year long, depending on which hemisphere you look at. Is this just a matter of routine business?
Well, I wouldn't call it routine. There's nothing routine about a hurricane or a typhoon. You know, when we ship into Guam and Guam gets more than their fair share of typhoons, and we have to deal with that a lot more than we do in Hawaii. They just seem to be right in the path in a lot of cases. And we also deal with typhoons that go into China and Hong Kong. And we never get used to it. You can never get used to something that you don't know what the impact's going to be. Typhoons and hurricanes are never business as usual. They're something you don't want. So, you know, people tend to not think about all the negatives. So it's something they keep out of their mind until they're sort of forced to deal with.
And typically, how long is the disruption to business before you get back to normal operating conditions around a storm like this, assuming there's not a devastation at the port?
Okay, well, I don't want to use Aniki as an example because the island of Kauai was really devastated. And you've seen what happened down in Puerto Rico. I mean, it's been a year and they're still not up to snuff. But based on the storms we've had in Hawaii in the past, other than Aniki, where the threat was there and businesses were closed, et cetera, it's normally a 2-day to 3-day delay.
And Brad, should there be a serious impact such as what happened during Hurricane Aniki, do companies like yours get used in the relief effort to resupply a place like Hawaii where you can't truck in things or bring them in on rail or they need to come by ship? How does the recovery process affect your business?
Well, it really depends. I know that in many instances, FEMA gets involved, and they sort of direct how it goes. And they will work directly with the ocean carriers like Pasha and Matson. And we've done some charitable work in the past where we've loaded containers with supplies, et cetera, at no charge. And we've worked with Matson to ship them to charitable organizations that are viable 501c3s. But, you know, each one of those is a separate incident where you have to go to Matson and get their approval. So we've done some things like that in the past. I'm not trying to toot our horn under the circumstances, but we do provide, like we're chartering half an airplane going into Honolulu, I believe in about 3 or 4 days. So, of course, if we could, we would fill the other half. And I don't want to profit from anybody's misfortune. Okay, that's not – if we never had a disaster, I'd be the happiest guy on the face of the earth. They bring problems.
And so you will switch to the more expensive air option if necessary, if seagoing is not available?
Yeah, well, even if seagoing is available, some supplies need to be shipped immediately. I'm trying to think of when it was, but there was a run on generators in Hawaii way back, a few years back, and we ended up air freighting for a hardware company a lot of generators because they were needed on island then. There are some things you can't wait for. So, of course, what you do is you use the method of transportation that's available that suits your requirements.
And, Brad, you mentioned just a minute ago that you don't have any interest in profiting off a disaster. In Hawaii, as in many other states, there's laws against price gouging during a state of emergency. But you also mentioned that you may have to use a more expensive option to get supplies in, like air cargo. How does the fact that a business, a retailer that's selling generators, to use your example, they're now having to pay more to get to rush their product in, but they're having to charge the normal price. Does that influence retailers' decision on whether or not to bring in new products as quickly as possible?
I've never seen a retailer that was more concerned about at least in Hawaii, that was more concerned about recovering their costs than they were about taking care of members of the community. Remember, we all live in Hawaii. I don't, but my people live in Hawaii. We work in Hawaii. We're members of the community. we consider ourselves Ohana. So, of course, we don't want to be in a position where anybody ever accuses us of price gouging, and neither do the retailers. They all live on island, too. So in all my dealings with most of the retail people I've ever dealt with, and I deal with a lot, I'm not aware of anybody ever saying to me, you know, I'm going to have to increase my prices to recover costs. It's an emergency. You get it done. Everybody works for a little less. You pull together as a community. You try to get the job done.
That was Brett Dechter speaking with the Conversations by Infinity about how the shipping industry deals with weather disruptions during hurricane season. Now, we run out of time today, but tomorrow we go back in time to the days of the pineapple cannery. The University of Hawaii's Oral History Center brings us voices of the ladies on the line. Do you have a cannery memory to share? Shades of that summer job in pineapple rash? Call us and share your story. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.